Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Samsung folding phones, you're doing it wrong, Apple and Qualcomm makeup, PlayStation 5 specs in the dark, dirty world, and fake Amazon reviews. All that more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 513, recorded on April 18th, 2019. Samsung folding phones, you're doing it wrong. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you all the hardware news, desktops, handhelds, mobile, consoles. We are down with it, except for those weird Internet of Things things that make our life miserable or completely compromise security in our homes. But we're not going to talk about that this week because it is all about the Apple-Qualcomm patent fight, which... Joining me right now from PCPer.com, Sebastian Peek, you have discovered the court date started to hit and all of a sudden people started settling left and right. This is such a court case kind of moment.
And as a bona fide non-legal expert, I can offer many different opinions and speculations that have no bearing on reality. But it was definitely interesting to see a couple of things happen, which one, as you mentioned, Apple kind of out of nowhere, it seems, just settles with Qualcomm right on the eve of going to court with, you know, their strongest case yet and whatever else we were reading about it, and paying Qualcomm some undisclosed sum, which is probably quite significant based on the claims that Qualcomm was making, which... in theory means that they will just immediately be able to start using Qualcomm 5G chips in an upcoming phone, which was kind of what this whole thing hinged on. And Apple had been in the background working with Intel on 5G modem technology. And for whatever reason, and you know, whatever you want to believe about Intel's progress with 5G modem technology, something definitely happened, and now all of a sudden we're reading news about Apple and Qualcomm agreeing to settle all of their ongoing lawsuits just completely out of court and start working together again, which is, I don't know how this struck you. I was quite surprised. And then when I read the subsequent Intel statement and then kind of some additional speculation about Intel and their progress with modem technology, it started to make a little bit more sense to me.
It's really, this is operating on multiple layers. Two, it's very messy. Three, it's international. But it comes down to Apple basically was like, Qualcomm's charging too much for their patents. Too much. And, you know, the patents at the core of, are kind of the core of where they get a huge amount of their profits, or as The Verge says, the vast majority of their profits. And Apple's been kind of getting its ass kicked in court. They're charging too much, ergo we do what we want plan. They lost in Germany, they lost in China, and Qualcomm won iPhone bans in Germany and China. They won a lawsuit in the U.S. That basically said, hey, they're patents. You get to pay what they want to charge you. Of course, Qualcomm has been sued for monopolistic behavior. They had a long sort of thing, a lawsuit with the Federal Trade Commission that they're waiting for the results to come back from. And what's kind of crazy is I think part of also the motivation for this, again, as The Verge notes, is that neither Apple nor Qualcomm want to start bringing up trade secrets in court, because as soon as trade secrets are brought out in court, funnily enough, they become part of the public record, which is awkward and painful and expensive if they are valuable trade secrets. They've signed up for a 6-year agreement with possibility of a 2-year extension, which is an awfully long time in the world of technology. The thing that you noted is, oddly enough, Apple's settling and Intel's getting out of the 5G modem business.
Yeah. They released this press release that just very bluntly stated that they were exiting the 5G business entirely. And well, they said they're going to focus on the data center and other opportunities, but very interesting that they go from claiming they have a 5G modem ready to go for Apple to, yeah, we're totally out if Apple and Qualcomm have made up in court. So,
I mean, on some level, I think that makes sense because, Apple would have been a significant customer. And without Apple, they're just going to get next to nothing in terms of customer base, or very likely to have next to nothing in terms of customer base, given how dominant Qualcomm is in the mobile world.
Yeah.
Do you think they actually had a functioning 5G modem that was good to go for the iPhone?
Well, I don't have any firsthand knowledge. I thought it was very interesting. Charlie at SemiAccurate posted news this morning, a story he'd been working on for a while, exploring Intel's efforts in that area. And he speculates that they did not have a working 5G modem at any point. He said that the technology that they had in the Apple iPhones that was sort of underperforming is why they had to sort of down-tune the Qualcomm modem performance to put them at the same 600 megabit per second range. And that was a modem that was originally promised to be a full gigabit. And so even a 1 gigabit LTE modem was underperforming enough. And apparently, although I don't have any verification of this, consuming up to 30% more power than the Qualcomm part, because they're using a larger process technology. So it was just kind of the worst of all worlds. It was built,
pardon me,
built
for
on
laughing.
14 nanometer. Yeah. Built on 14 nanometer, a little bit slower, consumes more power. And then they kept promising the new 5G chip, which it could very well be, as Charlie speculates, that whatever they went to deliver to Apple, or they had to admit to Apple, like, it's not ready, we don't have it, we're not going to have it, or they had to wait for another generation. So it's Apple's never been shy about dumping a platform and moving on to the next, like when they went to PowerPC, and then when they jumped on to Intel, when PowerPC couldn't deliver them that mobile G5 they'd been promised for a couple of years at that point.
Right.
So it kind of makes sense, but it's funny because I don't think Intel had any other I don't know who else would have been using the Intel modem. I don't think they had any other customers for this technology. It was like iPhone or nothing. And as soon as Apple settles with Qualcomm, it's just like, oh, yeah, we're out of this business. But I can't imagine that they would do that if they had a product. But who knows?
Hmm. What a mess.
Yeah.
As expensive as it may or may not have been, it's not like Apple didn't have the money to pay it.
In cash.
Yeah. Let's see. What's Qualcomm's annual revenue? Here we go. Qualcomm annual revenue, 202, where is it? $21.53 billion in 2018. Depending on what the current value of Apple's cash hoards are, but given that it was once reported at least like $150 billion, they could have paid seven times that.
And CNBC says that Apple has $245 billion in cash on hand.
Okay, so apparently my information is old at this point, but so they could have paid 10 times Qualcomm's annual revenue without borrowing money. What a wonderful place to be financially. Not a wonderful place to be the folding screens we have been seeing in the smartphone universe. Quoting CNBC, reports of broken Galaxy Fold review units are starting to pile up ahead of the April 26th release. CNBC's Todd Hazelton said his broke after 2 days. Dieter Bonn at The Verge says his broke after just 1 day. Mark Gurman of Bloomberg posted highly cited images of his broken screen, but revealed he had removed a thin film covering the screen, thinking it was a screen protector.
Yeah. That's happened to a couple of these reviewers, apparently, is unboxing it, seeing this plastic film that they could get their fingernail under and pulling it off. And then,
they weren't supposed to?
No. Apparently, it's actually part of the structure of this folding screen.
This is why we made a test.
Yeah. Now, I did see someone on Twitter posted a picture of the actual warning that's on this saying, do not peel off the plastic. So that was ignored by the people who did pull it off. But apparently The Verge, Dieter Bohn at The Verge, and I want to say it was the gentleman from CNBC, they claimed they did not pull the plastic off at all. And it was still either broken or had lost functionality within 1 to 2 days, with Dieter Bohn's phone sort of bulging on the back side, and then there was a line through the display on the front side after about a day.
Wow. That's awkward.
One thing that kind of strikes me as I've watched a couple of these videos is it's a really chunky device. I didn't really think about the fact that it would be as thick as two phones when it's folded, thinking it might be maybe 1.5 times, but it looks like half of two smartphones stacked on top of each other.
Well, it kind of literally is.
Yeah. And it doesn't fully close, of course. It's kind of that Microsoft, that Surface notebook of theirs where it didn't quite close all the way in the middle. There was always an air gap. And it has to be that way because you can't completely fold the screen. There has to be a slight curve to it at all times.
Yeah, if you don't keep the radius, it folds and not bends. M4, which bad. The crease, I think, when you look at, you know, Dieter Bohn was doing the write-up for The Verge, and there's a wonderful kind of, you can see where it's folding there. If you look at the center there, the crease is something that seems to be folding up on, showing up on folding screens, I should say, not folding up on showing screens. You know, it's, I like how he categorized it, you know, instead of thinking of it as a folding phone, he really thinks of it as a small tablet that happens to fold up. And you're right. It really does look like two phones that are kind of joined together by that screen technology. But, you know, it's curious, you know, outside of the screen dying and the sort of bit in the middle that's super distracting. I said the hinge mechanism felt solid. The software was robust and functioning, which may or may not be a normal thing with a beta Samsung fold. And his real issue with it, until of course the screen broke, was that there's that crease in the center. And I've gotten to see a few of these folding devices up close, and I will say, depending on what you're doing, you know, I don't know how, nobody's really used these for an extended period of time at this point, but I'm curious to see if the crease becomes more or less noticeable and more or less evident, because the OLED material these are being made out of, the LED material, OLED, hold on, I'm having a moment of not remembering the thing. The screen material doesn't stretch. You know, so what you can't tension it. I mean, you could tension it, but if you stretch the material breaks. Or if you attempt to stretch the material breaks. And that's, I don't know, it's going to be interesting. And it's a little shocking that, they were breaking. So...
it's
Samsung,
it's
also
easy.
Did a formal response.
Oh, yes. They're going to look into each of these incidents in person to investigate them. I'm sure that most of the blame will be put on the people who did not use them in accordance with the instruction manual, which apparently nobody read. So hopefully, as expensive as this is, at $1,980...
Yeah.
This is not something that will happen to people who are careful with it and do not take the plastic layer off of the screen, but still.
No, but they are saying distinctively, they're saying that removing the top layer of display is completely separate, a completely separate failure from some issue. You know, it's funny. They're incredibly vague. A limited number of early Galaxy Fold samples were provided to media for review. We have received a few reports regarding the main display on the samples provided. We will thoroughly inspect these units in person to determine the cause of the matter. They don't even say it cracked or it broke, right? This is spin control on a high level. I think in part because it sounds like they're shocked and they don't know what happened. But they seem to be, they are suggesting that the screen protector removal, and which causes broken screens, and the broken screen issue are two separate things. So, yeah.
And this launches on April 26th.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Verge piece, they quote, think a piece of debris got lodged under the folding display and damaged the OLED panel. So that was the follow-up on the Verge that Chaim Gartenberg wrote up with Dieter Bahn. I also got to give a shout-out to Chaim and Dieter for calling out that, quote, the Galaxy Fold screen failures aren't the worst disaster for Samsung in recent memory. That title still goes to the Galaxy Note 7, which Samsung ultimately had to recall entirely and cancel production due to exploding batteries. To this day, you still can't bring a Note 7 on a commercial airplane. That's just cruel, but pretty honest to point out. Oh, my goodness. We got hands on. Do you use a Harmony remote in your home theater or in your house?
I have one and I cannot remember the model. It's an older one.
It's okay. It doesn't have to be new. I bring it up because Harmony introduced, we did a review on Tech Thing this week. Harmony introduced a new remote this week, the Harmony Express, which is distinctive in that if you take a look at the buttons on this, it is a vastly simplified control compared to what we're used to seeing from Harmony. You can see it there in that sophisticated. There it is. There's a remote right there.
Oh, wow.
So instead of having like an LCD screen and 22 buttons, they are, as you might guess, using Amazon Alexa to bring voice commands or voice control to your home theater experience. So it is an interesting device. In part, because I'm very curious to see how it holds up under my beloved wife's scrutiny, because she hates Alexa and Google Home and anything else that talks back in the house, part one. And part two, because it kind of takes some time to get used to. Scroll up, if you're watching the video, scroll up Kevin OneShot. The setup is really interesting right there, because first you punch in all of your devices, which of course, because Harmony has this magnificent database of just about anything anyone's ever connected to a home theater or used in a home automation environment. But you drag and drop those buttons you can kind of see on the screen to connect. Like, okay, my AVR is connected to my television, and then my Apple TV, my Roku, my Blu-ray player, my this, my that are connected to these different HDMI ports on my AVR. I use my AVR, not a soundbar. You pick the different devices, and you sort of drag and drop the relationships, and then you have the ability to do things like call out what you are looking for. Turn on Apple TV, turn on Roku, watch Netflix. And it's interesting. They made a bunch of what I think are really, really smart decisions. For example, you don't have to ask for Alexa. You press that big blue button in the middle, and then you respond to the tone. You basically hit the button, ask it a question, and you get you get the thing you asked for. So right there, it's nice because if you already have 32 different voice control devices in your house, you don't have to worry about every time you're watching television to have 17 different answers from around the room coming back at you, which I actually really appreciated. Because in the back of my room in the back of my garage has a ton of voice controlled stuff, and it's a small enough room where many devices will answer if I'm not careful. So, you just saw this giant thought bubble collection of different commands you could run through it, mute television, go to Netflix app, go to ESPN. It'll control your over-the-air tuner. It'll control just about everything, but it does not have a lot of the stuff we've kind of started taking for granted in the world of Harmony remotes. For example, you know, I might press, you know, the Blu-ray. I might want to launch my Blu-ray player, and I hit the button for the activity for that on my Harmony remote, and several things happen. Like my projector powers on, my screen turns down, my AVR gets turned to the right HDMI channel. And in that universe, on the more sophisticated Harmony environments, you can do things like, you know, also have your lights dim and the curtains go down, right? And this is much more stripped down than that. Now, we don't know what they're going to add in the future, but right now it's a universal remote control that adds ALEXA, but it doesn't have a lot of the extendability we've seen out of the remotes from Harmony. You know, I've spent at this point a few more days with it, and two things are kind of coming out with this. Fundamentally, it works, and it's really, really simple. It almost feels like, after having all 32,000 buttons on a Harmony remote, it feels like there's a little bit less available or going on with it. And because it's so simple, it's, you know, it's kind of like if you're used to a regular television remote and using an Apple TV remote, you know, you may be convinced that there's stuff missing that you need. But mostly it's like, oh, I have to change a weird setting on my projector, which was probably going to require me getting the projector remote control anyway, just to make it simple. It's $249.
Wow.
Which, yeah, that's the part I think is kind of difficult. Not because that's sort of an unprecedented price for a Harmony remote, because, you know, the top of the line Harmony remotes are running, you know, a Harmony Companion is $150. The Harmony Elite is $350. That's their top of the line device. A basic Harmony Hub is $99 if you just want to control things with your smartphone. And then they have stuff that's inexpensive as the Harmony 350, which is their most basic remote. That's $50. The Harmony 665 is $70. What's kind of challenging for me about this one is it feels kind of cheap. I've heard some complaints. Some people are kind of frustrated that it doesn't have a phone remote for it. But quite frankly, I hate using my phone to control my home theater. You know, I find it more useful to be able to use a physical control, and it's easier on my family and people who visit. But I will say, for $250, you know, you have a blaster that goes by your equipment. You have an extender, you know, to put stuff into. For example, my case, my blaster is inside my media closet. My extender is hanging outside, cleverly hidden so that it will activate my projector. But for $250, I would like it to feel a little less cheap. It feels durable. It feels solid. It feels very, very loud when ALEXA answers you. And of course, you can do all the stuff like, you know, what's the weather? You know, what time is it in Uzbekistan? You know, all those odd questions people ask Amazon Alexa. Sorry. You know, but for $250, I want it to feel more solid. I'm a little frustrated by that. And the more I play with it, the more I'm like, you know, this is a premium price and it works very, very well. It does what it's supposed to do. Absolutely. But it would be nice if it didn't feel so damn cheap in my hands. Also, there have been a couple updates to the app that I am catching up on. It would be nice to be able to control the volume of ALEXA when it responds, because it can seem very, very loud around midnight when the rest of the house is sleeping and I'm quietly watching something that, you know, is not kid friendly or family approved. But interesting to see them moving in that direction. First Harmony remote we've seen in a very, very long time, and a different and more simplified tack than we've seen Logitech traveling on with the Harmony lineup. Also, I was kind of amazed to see how many Harmony, you know, remotes are still counting this one. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 remotes in the Harmony lineup. Again, running from $50 to $350. So they are hitting all of the notes, if you will. Not like a motherboard manufacturer with 34 new motherboards, but there's a lot of remote options. And still, you know, by far my favorite way to control a home theater, especially if you have a complicated one with lots of moving parts and devices. Excited, PlayStation 5? This get you stoked?
It's interesting. Some of the stuff, especially the storage part, is really kind of hard to fathom at this point, because it was an interview, and it was an exclusive interview with Wired Magazine that, who was this? It was the lead system architect, Mark Cerny, was talking about their next console, which they won't name, of course. They would only call it the next generation console. But we assume PlayStation 5. And I had seen Lisa Su, the CEO of AMD, on Twitter promoting this article and talking about the fact that their Ryzen Zen 2 CPU cores and Radeon Navi GPU was going to be in this new console. We had speculated previously about whether it was going to be Zen Plus or Zen 2, depending on how far into the development cycle they were with this new console. So it is interesting to see that they're using the latest architecture on both the CPU and GPU side. And so that was basically confirmed for us. They weren't getting into specifics like clock speeds, core counts, or anything. But they also mention storage, and they won't go into details about it, who makes it, etc. But it seems like it may very well be PCIe 4 because Cerny claimed that, quote, it has a raw bandwidth higher than any SSD available for PCs. So,
okay.
Well, I mean, yeah, you can interpret that in different ways, like raw bandwidth. So in theory, that would be like a PCIe 4.
Really fast if it was over NVMe, but it's on PCI. But it's really fast despite the throttling factor.
This would be really, really fast if it wasn't a 10-year-old thumb drive, but it is.
But yeah. It's also really early. I mean,
it is. I mean, are they talking 2020, about this? So next year.
Yeah, but it seems like for PlayStation, that just seems like an eternity. Like maybe they you know, are they doing this so that people don't buy, you know, PS4 Pros between now and the launch of this? Are they trying to not piss off their user base? I mean, I'm excited they talked about it being backwards compatible, but I don't know. I also feel like, oh, PC gaming's doing really well and the graphics are getting really fantastic, or the sort of delta between PC gaming graphics and console graphics is getting larger again and televisions are getting bigger. You know, is that why they're finally talking about a PlayStation 5? And, you know, I don't know. The whole drama element of this video game console that Sony has spent the last 4 years building is no mere upgrade. Oh, you're going to change everything, Sony? I will eat my hat, of course, when they produce something that changes my life. And
well, don't forget, Patrick, this is an 8K device.
Huh.
I'm not sure at what frame rate we're talking, but supposedly this is 8K capable. I don't know why you would need that. Maybe this is just for streaming 8K content in Japan. But
right. You're ready for the 8K lifestyle. You know, moving to an SSD seems kind of obvious. Quote, what took 15 seconds now takes less than 1.8 seconds to be exact. So I'm down with the launch of that. I also find it really amusing how much time, you know, between now Sony and a few weeks ago, Google, with the announcements of their streaming service, are like, instant gaming now. That 15 seconds? Why? You can get your game. You can get fragged in Fortnite even faster. we'll see. Tom's Hardware has been doing ray tracing on Pascal GPUs, benchmarked, I should say. Chris Angelina wrote this one up. I am. What did you think? That's all I'm going to say.
Well, yeah, you better have a really fast Pascal card if you're going to be doing this. Some of the numbers at the bottom end of the chart, if you go through, this is a pretty thorough look at it, is like if even though you technically can use a GTX 1060 6GB, you clearly don't want to.
Right.
Because you're not getting anywhere near acceptable frame rates or consistent frame rates. And then moving up the chain, it's not so bad once you get up to about a 1070, 1080. And right. A 1080 Ti is fine. But, you know, if you don't already own one of these cards, then the prices on them in the used market especially don't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to ray trace, don't spend money now for a 10 series card. Battlefield 5, 1080p, DX12, DXR Ultra settings, I presume, at Ultra. You know, that an RTX 2080 goes from 95 frames per second to 67 frames with ray tracing on. A Titan XP, remember how expensive the Titan XP was? That goes from 72 frames per second to 38 frames per second. A 1080 Ti goes from 67 frames per second to 34.6 frames per second when you turn ray tracing on. 1080 goes from 53 to 29. A 1660 Ti, hey, conveniently, I just bought one, goes from 52.5 frames per second to 29.1 frames per second. I'm not feeling that 29 frames per second is super awesome for Battlefield 5.
No, I mean, I think that's 99th percentile, but that's something you're actually going to feel in the game. They have a lot of different charts for these different results. They had, what is this one? They have the total frame times. They have unevenness, which is something I haven't really seen before, where they go through and try to analyze what you would perceive as stuttering. And basically, even the Titan XP had some average and a slight amount of visible stuttering. A 1080 absolutely did. So, you know, the 1660 Ti does remarkably well, especially compared to a 1070. So if you're buying a current generation card and you get like a 1660 Ti, this is something you can play with. When they announced this change that was coming, this April driver that was going to enable this DXR stuff for these older cards, it didn't make sense to me that you'd game on these cards. What I liked was that they were simultaneously releasing these real-time ray-traced demos and enabling the technology on all cards. So it was essentially giving people an at-home demo. If they already own a Pascal card, or if they bought one of the 16 series cards and they want to experience ray tracing at home, they can. It might only be 30 frames per second, but they can at least watch the demo, get a taste for it. And if they really like it, that would, I'm sure, in theory, drive sales of some 20 series cards. So this is apparently not going to be the answer long-term. Even at 1080, gaming with ray tracing without the dedicated RT cores, clearly there's enough of a performance penalty that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
But it's an option.
I
have complicated feelings about that. Something cheerful to end on. I've been a fan of FakeSpot for a long time. You know, sometimes I think it's a little too aggressive in how it re-ranks things. If you're not familiar with FakeSpot, it's a website that runs an algorithm against listings on Amazon, products sold on Amazon and other places, and it tries to tell you how many of the reviews seem to be fake. What camel is for pricing, this thing aims to be for dissecting the veracity of the reviews on a website. And some of the response to that is I've occasionally had responses along the lines of, I can't really believe a company would, you know, pay people to write fake reviews. But Zachary Crockett over The Hustle, this is a great deck. I spent 2 weeks in the underbelly of Amazon's fake review economy and emerged questioning our collective trust in the stars. Now, my collective trust in the stars is kind of low in a lot of ways. One of the high water points for not trusting reviews was when, you know, the Lord of the Rings releases, I think, were, you know, people were pissed that they didn't have the extended editions immediately. And I think they, I think like 32,000 people or some ridiculous number collectively gave the not available, not yet sold box set or discs or whatever they were, like a 1-star review, because they wanted to express their displeasure. They were throwing a temper tantrum on the internet, which is unusual, temper tantrums on the internet. But, you know, he's talking to an Amazon seller who's headquartered in China, you know, and the Amazon seller basically says, you know, quote, if I gave her phone charger a 5-star review, she would refund the purchase via PayPal and send me a $10 commission. And he asked if it was illegal, and the Amazon seller's response was, "You will love. No, you will love." And this is one of the highest ranked phone chargers on the website. 3,971 five-star reviews and a trusted Amazon Choice label. And you know, what you find out is there are a lot of fake reviews. And one of the websites they brought out is one that was new to me, was Review Meta. So, you know, if you haven't played around with FakeSpot or Review Meta, it's definitely worth your time. One of the graphs on this chart tracks fake reviews on Amazon. But one of the lines from the story is that when Amazon began to push really, really, really hard for these direct sales companies from China, is that the amount of fake reviews spiked. And, you know, you look at these, this sort of this graph of fake spot lines, you know, where it goes from like 2015, they're averaging like 10, 15%, maybe 12% fake reviews. And then it spikes between 2015 and 26, up around 50%, you know, and you've got this long, lazy line you can see there if you're watching on the video that suggesting, you know, 25 to 30% of the reviews at any time are probably fake. And one of the challenges, you know, of this is for example, someone I know who reviews headphones has difficulties because in a lot of cases, for example, earbuds, a company will, you know, go to Shenzhen, have somebody build, you know, basically buy a container of earbuds. They ship those to Amazon. They create a company to do that. And then once the earbuds are sold out, the company kind of disappears. So there's no real warranty or service or anything like that over time. And in many cases, you know, as this article so wonderfully illustrates, is there's a certain flexibility towards believing that reviews should be legitimate. you know, and it's frustrating, you know, because I would like to be able to rely on the reviews. On Amazon, I certainly take them with a grain of salt. And still, if it's anything I'm buying, if it's anything I'm buying of consequence or anything that's a real pain in the ass if it fails, I have a very short list, for example, of USB cables I'll buy. And we were talking about USB-C chargers for laptops on Tech Thing this week. And it's alarming how bad some of the USB-C chargers are in terms of not delivering the rated power supply or having heat issues. Or, you know, being able to light things on fire if things go wrong. So in any case, it's a good read if you're kind of curious learning more about some of the mechanisms and some of what's going on in the background. It spends a lot of time talking about the creator of Review Meta, but it's an interesting experience if you've never done it to take a product listing and put it on FakeSpot, put it on Review Meta, and see what the response is to that is, you know, the quote, "In a spot check run prior to the publishing of this article, I confirmed Noonan's findings. 10 of the 22 first page results on Amazon for iPhone charger were products with thousands of five-star reviews, all unverified and posted within a few days of each other." Incentivized reviews, by the way, is illegal under federal law in the United States. You're not allowed to trade products or payments to get good covey. Good cover, good copy. You know, Amazon banned incentivized reviews in 2016. And it's interesting that the FTC has finally started prosecuting stuff. But, you know, it's kind of crazy. Review Meta's analysis tool is a great chart. 49% of headphones, the Amazon items with the highest percentage of fake reviews: headphones, 49%; cell phone accessories, 37%; business books, 20%; pest control, 18%; you know, TV and video, romance books, security surveillance, self-help books, computer accessories, all between 15% and 18%. You know, if you're kind of curious how it works, it's a great article. You know, and a little horrifying.
Yeah, I don't really have any faith in Amazon reviews unless, I don't know, somehow the ones with pictures make me feel better, but those could very well be sponsored as well. A lot of times I would read through a review and it would say, you know, my opinions are my own, but I was provided this product for free in exchange for my unbiased review, which right. kind of went away. I think Amazon cracked down on that. But now when they aren't even putting that disclaimer up, I have no idea which ones are real or not.
And in full faith and disclosure, both you and I are regularly sent very expensive things from, you know, Intel or AMD or Lenovo or whoever, you know, Dell. I can't afford to buy a $2,000 Dell laptop, so they'll send one for a loan period. But I think we're pretty clear about that. It gets a little, you know, it's alarming when you've seen a product that has obvious massive issues. And then there's a lot of, because I've seen that where you can see where like the average on a product was like 1.5, 2 stars, and all of a sudden there's this flood of super great, awesome, you know, cleared my acne up and made my cat look 3 pounds thinner. You know, it's frustrating. I still like to look at the reviews, but you know, there's no doubt that it's full caveat emptor, buyer beware. They're getting kind of ugly. You know, I don't know if I've noticed this as badly at Newegg, but in many cases, motherboard reviews I still look at a lot. There's not a lot of review culture built around Newegg, but I remember at one point several years ago having a motherboard fail, going to the Newegg listing and realizing that, like, you know, it was sitting at like 3 stars because literally half of the people that had reviewed it had had the motherboard die. So, maybe you're perhaps you are more paranoid than I am by nature, which is a utterly terrifying thing to contemplate, but, oh goodness. It's also interesting because a friend of mine was reviewing a camera device recently, and, you know, the experience, my personal favorite part was, my personal favorite part was reading a review of the app that was associated with the device. And I may as well name it. It's the Arsenal Smart Camera Assistant. Shannon was using it. But it was like this super awesome. It was a 5-star review of the app that goes along with this $200 device that's supposed to replace the intelligence inside of your camera and give you superior sort of photographic results in your photographs, and does a lot of things that are very, very difficult to set up manually on a camera. But it was like, you know, this 5-star review was like, this is really awesome. It's almost impossible to connect sometimes, but when it works. And I was just like, what a low bar for a 5-star review. It doesn't always work, and sometimes it's a tremendous pain in the ass, but when it does.
Hey, but their honesty was rewarded with that full refund plus commission. So
I don't think, no. In this case, let us not. Arsenal is a separate company. They came out of a Kickstarter.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about one person's review of the application that I thought was ironic because of the way they were. I think they legitimately loved it. They were just being honest about how sometimes it's difficult to connect. In other cases, it's almost impossible to connect. I in no way want to suggest that Arsenal is anything but above board with its reviews. So it's a really cool idea. Shannon was really kind of heartbroken, you know, because it just would not connect to her phone. And it seems to be a software issue. And I actually have a lot of sympathy for any small startup-y kind of company that's trying to make a complicated gadget work, not only with A, expensive cameras, but B, whatever Android phones somebody shows up with. That's a nightmare in the world of development and setup. So... PeacePro.com. Anything you can tease that you're working on right now, sir?
Well, there's a couple things in the works that I can't talk about. And one thing that you will notice if you go to the site before the end of this month is we are transitioning on the back end to a completely new website.
That's exciting.
That's taken up. Yeah, this current design is quite a bit dated, and we're finally moving on to what looks like an actual modern website. So, and it's built on WordPress, so it'll be a lot easier for us to use on the back end. Everybody's sort of cheering about that. WordPress is a sponsor of Twit, but this was something that our owner Jim has been working on for a while. He's working with some developers to get the whole site moved over. I know it was something that Ryan absolutely agonized over because he knew the site needed a redesign, but it's such a major undertaking to move years and years worth of material that spans three different websites. Yeah. Remember, this is a site that started as k7m.com, I think, and then it moved on to amdmb.com. It was an AMD Athlon motherboard enthusiast site. And then eventually he changed the name to PC Perspective and made it more of a general PC hardware site. So it's been quite a while. It's been since around 2000 or so that it's been on the internet in one form or another. So we're excited about that. I think by the end of April, you'll see the new site up. And there'll be some new content coming, but like I said, I can't talk about everything I'm working on right now.
I wish you nothing but smooth transitions and easy content porting. And that your Google SEO doesn't get completely foobarred in the process.
I'm a little terrified of the whole process, but hey.
It's a perfectly reasonable response. It's like upgrading your firmware. No matter how many times you've done it, you still want to back up everything first and make sure that there's just no opportunity for a terrible, terrible fail that will change your life in a negative way. Well, that was cheerful. You've been listening to the Cheerful Podcast This Week in Computer Hardware. We call it Twitch. You can find all the older episodes and how to subscribe at twitch.tv/TWICH. Look, there's Sebastian and there's Patrick on This Week in Computer Hardware. If this is your first episode, thank you so much for joining us. If you've been listening for years, thank you so much for hanging in with us. We really appreciate it. We are on the Twitters at Sebastian Peeker, at Patrick Norton. And if you have a question for us, that is a great place to send it to, because we answer in shockingly short amounts of time, except when we don't. How's that for a promise, people? PCPro.com is where you can find more of Mr. Peek's musings on hardware in his magnificent benchmarking results. And we hope in the near future, as they transition to a new platform, it will continue to be located at PCPro.com and findable by Google. So keep heading over there, because darn it, traffic helps. And you can find me over at TEKTHING, that's techthing.com, or the audio and video podcast I do with Robert Herron called AVExcel, AVExcel.com is the website for that one. Thank you so much for listening or watching. We really, 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 really appreciate you being out there. With that, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peek.
Catch you next week on Twitch.